Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the podcast Dr. Newt Jacobson, who is editor of a fascinating new OUP publication, Hindu Diasporas, as part of the Oxford History of Hinduism series. Newt, welcome back.
Thank you.
So how did you end up editing a volume on Hindu Diasporas?
I have been working on the Hindu diasporas part of my research for many years. Actually, the editor of the series, the Oxford History of Hinduism, asked me to propose a volume on the Hindu diaspora. So I was presenting some of my material on Hindu goddess temples in Europe and Norway at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. And in that connection, Gavin Flood asked me about it. So, I was also able to present one of my chapters at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies at a later occasion. Now, he suggested it titled Hindu Diaspora, but I changed it to Hindu Diasporas using the plural term because I thought that was kind of descriptive of the situation. The Hindus are part of many different diasporas, but the focus of the book is, of course, religion. So,
I imagine the majority of our audience will be familiar with the term diaspora, but let's perhaps unpack it a little bit. What is a diaspora?
Now the term, as it's used now, has to do with migration, and it means that the migrations have taken place, and that the group the identity of the group is connected to this ancestral homeland. So that's part of their collective identity. So it means dispersal, and this dispersal, if there is this connection to the original place, then we can talk about the diaspora. It has become very common as part of migration research. So I think the term maybe had a more limited meaning maybe 30, 40 years ago, but now it's connected to one aspect of migration. And of course, religion plays an important role in connecting to that ancestral homeland, and therefore it has It has particular interest for religious studies. It's part of the kind of the global dynamics of religion, I would say.
Yeah, it's a prevalent and fascinating and sort of increasing phenomenon. And if I'm not mistaken, the term literally comes from a Jewish term for the scattering of the seeds. But, you know, so we have Hindus all over the world. Yes.
It's used actually a Greek word. So it means dispersal of the Greeks to the island. But for the Jews, it has a particular meaning because there it was kind of people without land. So it was that. But now it's used by a person who really, have come from nations. So in a way, they are not without land, but it's that dispersal. So,
So we have Hindus all over the world. When did this start? When are some of the earliest diasporas, Hindu diasporas?
So the first chapter of the book is about Cambodia and the spread of, you find the Hindu tradition in Southeast Asia. And then how did that come about in the first millennium of the common era? So then I think maybe 100, 150 years ago, it was proposed that this had to do with migration from India. But then as this has been researched, it's has more to do with kind of trade, seafarers, and movement of maybe Brahmins and traders who would settle for some periods, so that it's still open, but research now think that is not that kind of diaspora as we talk about that as we use the term now, but it was certainly an enormous influence of Sanskrit and Hindu Buddhist culture. The diaspora comes about with the British Empire and the movement of people within the British, French, and other colonial empires. And it really takes off with the indentured labor. So that is the prohibition of slavery in 1833 in the British Empire. And then the replacement of slave labor. Part of the kind of plantation economy, that the slaves would not work on the plantations once they didn't have to. And then I think the colonial powers tried different things, but what worked best was the recruitment of laborers in India and on 5 and 10 years contracts. And the recruiters were paid. There was a lot of ethical problems around it. My impression is that the Indian indentured laborers, at least the first decades, were not treated very much better than the slaves. So there has been a lot of attention to the Atlantic slave trade, but actually the trade in the Indian Ocean, which also was quite large, has not been, I think, given enough attention. But that's how the diaspora takes off, these indentured labors go to Trinidad, to Guyana, South America, Mauritius, to Southern Africa, Fiji. So very widespread around the world. So that is the Now, to some of these places, like Mauritius, there were also Hindus who had traveled before, traders, and who had actually managed to get land and were in a very different economic situation, but the numbers were smaller. So it's with the indentured labor that we can talk about the old diaspora. And their situation, of course, was very different from what we call the new diaspora, which is the migrations after, let's see, 1965, or where it really takes off.
So let's stay with the old diaspora for a moment, this movement through indentured labor. So we have thousands of laborers who are being moved across the ocean for the sake of work. So these are workers, these are laborers. Mm-hmm. So given that context, how is it that Hinduism, how is it that the religiosity mm-hmm. is transmitted, is preserved, you know? One might think, I mean, obviously, if you have experience on the ground, you see that it's been quite vibrantly preserved and transplanted, so to speak. But one might think, well, we have a class of laborers and we have, you know, whereby does the religion get transplanted?
So, of course, these were poor people. And it gets transplanted on these very kind of small temples for protection, gods and goddesses. So maybe Hanuman, who is also a kind of protector god. So it's, and I think maybe in the beginning that this is not the first concern, because there are so much troubles, but it gets... it's not forgotten, but it's being built up, and typical non-Brahmanical type of religion, and often gods and goddesses having to do with protection. So they would be they would get at the plantation, maybe some corner, there would be a small place for these protection gods and goddesses. And interesting, if you go and visit today, maybe there would be a large Brahmanical temple there. So these, many of these temples that are today Brahmanical and kind of significant classical Agama types of temples started as a small, maybe a stone with red paint, etc. So there has been a kind of an enormous development.
Do we have a sense of, so how to say, so we have these simpler shrines established by the laborers, eventually developing into Agamic temples proper through Brahmanic means. So then where do the Brahmins come in? Where does a class of scholar priests come into this context, or do they?
I think there has been, after 1970, at least a revival of Hinduism in and Hindu traditions in many of these old diasporas. Now the Arya Samaj sent missionaries to these old diaspora places, trying to promote their kind of ideology. Brahmins were also traveling, going to these places. So there would be opportunities also for these Brahmins. And so you would get maybe after a while two types of temples, non-Brahmanical and non-Brahmanical. But one of the chapters of the book on the Tamil Shaiva diaspora is very interesting on this topic, because it shows that before the 1970s, Shaiva Tamil Brahmins would not travel abroad. I mean, maybe a few did, but it was not very common, and it was considered a negative thing. But when this changed in the 80s, it has changed so that it has become the kind of the ambition of young Tamil Shaiva priest to do to go abroad and work on these temples in the diasporas. So that has become a kind of a good way of life. Many of these Tamil Shaiva Brahmin priests work in temples, you know, a few years here, a few years there. So one of my field trips in this connection in Malaysia, in a Tamil temple there, I just talked with a Tamil priest, and he showed me, you know, on his phone that he had been in Oslo, the capital of Norway, a year ago, and in a few months he was going to start work in a temple there after having worked in a Tamil Shaiva temple in Malaysia for some years. So there is this now this global market of for these Tamil Shaiva priests, which would have been unthinkable 50 years ago.
So it's incredible. It really is incredible, the power of innovation, adaptation, and this really this peculiar but useful sort of mix within the Hindu world of utter tradition and utter innovation. And mm-hmm. and you know, we think of, you know, Hinduism might be technically the world's oldest living religion, but what parts of it have remained untouched and untransformed? And there is one temple that I visit, just because it's just a gorgeous, glorious temple. It's north of Toronto. I don't have any particular connection to the Tamil community personally in my own heritage, but it is a Tamil temple in Richmond Hill. It's a large and relatively old. They began building it in the late 70s or early 80s, which is, I mean, even Toronto was sort of white and bright then, much less an hour away from Toronto. It's incredible, actually. And I had this rather surreal experience where earlier this year I went to Australia for the first time to hold a retreat. I've been holding international retreats, and I was in Brisbane. And the flight, you know, the flight left me a little bit discombobulated. And for some strange reason, I woke up Friday morning. I had a few hours. I had to get to Byron Bay, where the retreat was, later that evening. But I had the day to kind of rest and do something. And I thought to myself, I had this intuition, you know what? I want to seek out a temple. I don't know why. Perhaps part, you know, armchair ethnography, perhaps part just looking to center and recharge before I had to discharge this retreat. And just the intuition said, you know, so I said, okay, well, let me be a millennial and pull out my iPhone and look in Google Maps and see, you know, Hindu temples. And of course, a zillion come up, because there are a zillion Hindu temples in every major city these days. But okay, great. And I see one, one's called a Durga temple. Okay, well, let's see some Shakta traditions. As you may know, much of my writing is on goddess narratives. So let me see this Durga temple. Tiny temple in the middle of nowhere. I go there. I talk to the man. He asks me, you know, he speaks Tamil and I speak no Tamil, so we're speaking in English. And he, you know, I said, I'm from Toronto. Basically, he used to work at the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple, an hour north of Toronto. His brother-in-law is the head priest there. And here he is in Brisbane. And I'm thinking to myself, well, what are the odds that I fly across the world and it's the same vamsha, it's the same lineage, it's the same family officiating. It's fascinating. So I have direct knowledge of what you mean by there's this wonderful, not to denigrate it, but there's this wonderful sort of spiritual franchising of officiation, which is great. Mm-hmm.
So the whole world is now Hindu space. So,
and I just love, if ever I catch a temple, if ever I catch like a puja where they're either doing like a yagya, a homam, like a fire ritual or something more elaborate, you know, the sankalpa, there's a ritual sort of stamp where they announce, it's brilliant. They locate the ritual in sacred space and sacred time. And you will all of a sudden you'll hear Sanskritized versions of, you know, Kannada Deshe in the country of Canada, Ontario Pradeshe in the province of Ontario, Toronto Nagare. They're ritually locating themselves within where they are physically. In it's fascinating, utterly fascinating. Okay. So so the early chapters of the volume talk about the perhaps the first waves of migration due to indentured labor. How many Hindus, how many folks do we have as part of this wave? Ish.
No, I'm not sure actually of the actual numbers, but because people also did return, and then so I'm not sure about it. I mean, the numbers are not that high. I mean, because these places were small, like Mauritius, there were, I think, no population there before, or hardly any. It was an unpopulated island. Fiji, quite small island. And then Suriname, maybe 34,000 to Suriname. Mauritius, 60,000. But I should be careful with those.
No, indeed. In the tens of thousands, for sure. In the tens of thousands, for sure, and probably in the Caribbean overall, probably close to about 500,000 laborers overall. Just to give folks who are listening a sense, of course, you know, those interested for research and teaching and personal interest will, of course, purchase the book and dive in. But just to give sort of an overview, you mentioned earlier that beyond this sort of early wave, this wave in beginning mid 19th century, ending early 20th century of indentured labor, that we have sort of the second wave of Hindu migration. Tell us about that.
I should say, though, before we start, that there is also this Kangani system that is goes to Malaysia, Burma, and the hills in Sri Lanka. And there, I think we are talking about maybe 4 million, something like that. So that was really much bigger numbers, because these were very close, much closer to India. So the travel was much shorter. So that was, it's a little bit similar, but here it was... the recruitment system was a little bit different, and the salary system a little bit different. But and of course, with the distances being shorter, they're also the kind of going back and forth a little bit different. But then with the new diaspora, let's see, after the, let's say 1947, with the independence of India, that would be a way to start it. But if you look at Britain, the migration to Britain of Hindus before 1960 was really very limited. There were Indian, sailors and factory workers, but actually the majority were Sikhs and Muslims. So that the Hindus were quite few. And there is a very interesting study on Indians in Britain, maybe 62, 63, and the author makes a point to explain why there will never be Hindu temples in India, in England, and explained why Hindus don't need temples, they can worship in a home, etc. So then by the 1960s, this changes. And in the United States, they talk about 1965 because of the change of the immigration laws. But in Europe, migration from India and South Asia takes off during those same years. So the first Hindu temple in Britain, for instance, opens in 1967. And already in the beginning of the 1970s, the planning of the first kind of monumental Hindu temple in the United States starts. So it after that, it goes quite quickly. So that's the, and then the same, I think, to Australia also, that type of migration. And it is kind of a mixed migration to Britain in the beginning, labor migration, but then also People come for education, and then also more middle class type of occupations. It creates kind of very pluralistic type, I would say, dominated by Gujaratis play an important role. And then with the kind of Africanization politics in Eastern Africa, the movement of Indian migrants from East Africa to Europe. It's an interesting thing that India was asked to admit some of those Indians from East Africa to come to India. But the Indian government said that these people are not Indians. They are now Africans. So the idea, the Indian state, their kind of embracement of an Indian diaspora happened in the 1990s. When with Indian independence in 1947, India had to decide, the Indian state had to decide about the diaspora. And they denied that these people were Indians, that India had no responsibility for them, and that they should adapt to the and assimilate in the nation that they lived in. So it's a very interesting history on the Indian nation state's view of the what we today call Indian or Hindu, or which is part Indian diaspora, which a large part of that is Hindu diaspora. It was only in the 1990s this changed. And in the book, I discuss why this happened. And of course, the diaspora, the Hindu diaspora, Indian diaspora in the United States played an important role in this, changing the perception of who the diaspora people were. The indentured labor were low caste, and while the Hindu diaspora in the United States were upper caste, very successful middle class, they had economic resources that India needed, etc. So it's a very interesting. That's why some would say that it's kind of the Indian diaspora is a very politicized concept, but it's also, I would say, a kind of an academic concept also. So whatever the Indian state might think about it, from a religious studies point of view, the dispersal of Hindus around the world would be the same in a way. It's still a Hindu diaspora. So.
Yeah, it raises some very interesting questions about identity and about national identity versus religious identity versus ethnic identity. And there are fascinating parallels. I mean, oftentimes when I use the word Indian as in, you know, Indian religions, I think most people gather by now, I mean, civilization or, you know, South Asia, you know, Bharata, you know, not nation state. So a great analog that is around the same age is Israel, the nation state, often gets conflated with Israel, the covenant, Israel, the people, the culture, and so we use the word Indian in many ways. And so when you have, for example, Hindus who are second and third generation American or Canadian or Australian or British, you know, then they have a nation state. You know, I know a number of people, a number of Jews in Toronto who feel a call to the nation state of Israel, a number who feel that they have a nation state. It's called Canada. and so the fascinating, the phenomenon you're pointing to raises fascinating questions about politics and identity and of course caste, and you know, the idea also that the now more antiquated idea, but in traditional Orthodox Hindu culture, that once you cross the river, that's it. You've lost ties with the motherland. You've lost caste, period. You know, you're a de facto outcast because you've crossed the ocean. You've left the motherland. So it really, really is fascinating. What are some of the most popular or densely populated spaces? What are some of the most common destinations across the Hindu diaspora?
The largest population of Hindus outside of South Asia is in Bali, Indonesia, around 4 million. And then United States, 2.5 million Hindus. In Europe, in Canada, I think more than around 500,000, maybe. And in Europe, 2 million altogether, but half of that is in Britain, 1 million Hindus. So that's while in other European countries, France, Germany, Portugal, Italy. So the migration to Europe is very much shaped by colonial history in a way that Tamils would go to France. So the most spoken South Asian language is in France is Tamil. And the greatest number of Hindus with the Tamil background in France are actually from Sri Lanka, Ilan Tamils. And they, interestingly, in Europe, they make up a majority of Hindus in several countries, like Germany, Switzerland, Scandinavian countries. While in Britain, Hindus from Gujarat, especially coming from East Africa, make up the majority. In United States, Vasudha Narayanan, who write about that chapter, I think writes that about half of the Hindus in United States have college degrees, or that is kind of that higher education, first and second. So it's also the wealthiest Hindu population in the world. And she makes a very interesting comparison between the temple building craze that was in Cambodia in the first millennium, and also in partly in Southeast Asia, but with Angkor Wat, and what happened in the United States with the building of monumental temples. She thinks that this has a kind of the last time you had this kind of temple building enthusiasm was in the Khmer Kingdom, and then in the United States in the 20th, 21st century, which is a very interesting comparison. And also, yes, in the United States, also very interesting dynamics, I think, with this establishment of monumental temples also as pilgrimage places and symbols and cultural centers. And yeah.
So for those listening, the first part of the book covers a number of geographical locations. Of course, Vasudha Narayan's article on Cambodia in the first millennium, and of course, the Caribbean, Suriname in particular, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, Europe, America. And the second part of the volume talks not about places, but themes. So let's maybe turn to that. What are some themes that we see, prevalent themes across the Hindu diaspora?
So I wanted to cover, the largest groups. And one theme that we already talked about is the Tamil Hindu diaspora. It's a global phenomenon, and it's quite dominant in many countries. And it has this, we already talked about, but there are this kind of the whole world has become that type of Tamil Shaiva space. They are, the second theme is about the Gujarati diaspora. That's also a dominant diaspora. Those two are the largest one. An interesting one is Shaiva and one is Vaishnava. So I thought that also was somewhat representative to focus on these two themes. That chapter on the Gujarati diaspora has one very good, nice feature is that she also studies some part of views and understanding that are not necessarily manifest in the temples, but get manifest in family religion. And she talks about boots and idea of ghosts and some of these kind of folk traditions, which I think are understudied. A third chapter is then on Shaktism and the Shakta traditions, which are also with a focus on temples, I think, from my own study of Shakta tradition in Europe, is that these traditions are often somewhat, some of the Shaktism are quite unique, dependent on individual persons who have had maybe a vision of the goddess being asked to build a temple at that particular spot. The largest Hindu temple in continental Europe is a Shakta temple, a Tamil, Ilan Tamil Shakta temple. Of course, there is a chapter on the temple, in the Hindu temple in the diaspora, and a chapter on pilgrimage places, that is the establishment of Tirthas outside of South Asia, which I have written. I find it's a very, I'm interested in Tirthas and pilgrimage, and it's a fascinating thing that, and I think that's part of, I think, maybe old conceptions of Hinduism kind maybe misunderstood this ability of the Hindu tradition to globalize, because wherever Hindus settle, their gods travel with them, and their sacred sites are unproblematically established at these places. So the establishment of Tirthas, seeing the sacred at sites, I think then is a part of the Hindu view of the world, and not something limited to the geography of India. And then there is a chapter on Hindutva and in diaspora. And I think with a very good conclusion, politically, the Hindus in the diaspora are as, you know, polarized as they are in India. So there are all kinds of views. The diaspora is not to be identified with any particular political views. One chapter on which I was interested in the interaction or a lack of interaction between the diaspora Hindus and what's called new Hindus, or Hindus, people converting to Hinduism or becoming followers of Hindu gurus or Hindu practices. Amanda Lucia has written a chapter on the guru movement, you have to read it. It's an excellent chapter, but the early the early gurus who came to United States, they kind of used the Orientalist idea of India very actively to promote their own teachings, and which was very successful. And then on ISKCON, the last chapter is on ISKCON and Hare Krishna movement, because there you have, I think in there, some of their temples, at least, maybe the most interaction between diaspora Hindus and new followers. Bhaktivedanta Manor in outside of London, the George Harrison, the Krishna temple that he gave to ISKCON, and then, you know, the Gujarati Hindus moved in that area, and in a way, I wouldn't say took it over, but they became, you know, it became their temple also. So that's an interesting kind of movement where you can see this two types of Hindus, we could say, then, and where they meet them. And then notably also the interests are often quite different. I think the ISKCON, they often kind of were reacting against, their motivation was a critique of a culture. They wanted to kind of to spiritualize the world against materialism, etc. While for the Hindus, going to a temple is more the preservation, I think, of kind of an everyday and kind of an everyday practice, not a critique necessarily of the world, but a way to kind of to go on living in the world. So there is this, at least potential, of having very different approaches to the use of religion. And so,
fascinating themes all. And without playing favorites, which we don't do, I also was quite all fascinating and important works, but I quite enjoyed Amanda Lucia's paper, very cheekily named Persistent Fictions. The extent to which the global gurus, you know, well, they perhaps maybe propagating spiritual truths, nevertheless, in order to do so, they were propagating sociocultural concepts related to caste hierarchies and the well-trodden tropes. So fascinating work. So from your perspective, you know, when you edit a volume like this, you are afforded a bird's eye perspective. And how do I phrase this? I ask this question often, but I find different ways to phrase it pending the particular conversation. You know, what was impressed upon you? You know, did anything surprise you? Did anything strike you about this array of papers?
Yeah, I think they were all very good. And that's a difficult question. I wouldn't say that I was surprised by anything, but I was... I would think it rather confirmed, and I expanded on my empirical knowledge, but and I got what I think more examples to confirm ideas about this that I already have, I think. So I don't think the book, you know, I mean, it, for people who have less knowledge about this, they will maybe learn new kind of large kind of things. But I think, I mean, I was surprised about one thing, and that was that I didn't know before how the Indian nation state had dealt with the diasporas. Before, I mean, from 1947, and when it changed in the late 1990s, it was new to me that the Indian nation state were unwilling to accept anyone from East Africa who didn't have any. I mean, they had, I think they had British passports because that's part of that. But so that I was actually, that I read it, I was quite shocked about it. And also that they, the Indian nation, had refused the Indian population in the indentured labor, that it, or the Indians in Malaysia, Burma, etc., to accept them as Indians. I mean, because we had been so used to thinking, I mean, I have at least become so used to thinking that these, this was an Indian diaspora, and that so that was quite shocking to me, I have to say. So so I write about that in introduction essay quite a bit, because and then, and it made me understand also how kind of the change in 1990, how dramatic that was. I knew from before that in Indian movies, persons who came from diaspora and who had role in 1970s, 80s, they were often ridiculed a little bit in the movies. They were looked at kind of simpletons, outsiders, while in the Bollywood movies in the 1990s, they become heroes. So there is this transformation, which is part also of globalization, of course, and of many things, but it is kind of an interesting, and it was shocking to me to see what happened in 1940, and there are good reasons for why maybe the Indian nation states did. I mean, it was a new nation state. It was one of the first colonies to gain independence. There were many things going on. So someone has to understand it in its own context. But as we read it today, it's quite, you know, I mean, surprising, I would say.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's great that overarchingly, you know, from what I'm gleaning from what you're saying, you know, studying the Hindu diaspora yourself, you probably had a great deal of knowledge, and also as with all of us who study, we have a great deal of suspicions. We have a great deal of things that we suspect to be true or intuit, or generalizations that we can draw or infer, and it's always nice to have the data confirm what we suspect. But now this process sounds like one where that you've been afforded the opportunity to empirically verify many of your suspicions about the Hindu diaspora. Regarding the part that surprised you, thank you for sharing that. It's, I find it fascinating. For me personally, perhaps if I were, if I were in your perspective, I too would be surprised by that. But in my particular case, the only reason I'm not remotely surprised by that is because of my own lived experience. So I was born in what was used to be British Guyana. And so I came to Toronto at a very, very young age. And Toronto has been home. And so, you know, there are a number of experiences one has throughout the 80s regarding experiences with people who have been in Toronto forever, immigrants from a variety of backgrounds. And yeah, times have changed now a great deal, because now who knows who's from where. You know, you visit Italy and you see a person who appears of Indic origin, but they speak Italian with an English they speak English with an Italian accent, as if somebody who's been in, you know, in Venice for 10 generations. And so you know, but you know, those from a West Indian background in particular, I can say they well know that they don't belong, they didn't belong to the world to which they emigrated. They were second-class citizens by and large. Times have changed, obviously, and they did not belong among the Indian community from whom they were outcasts. And it was a coin toss as to which marginalization was more visceral. And when we think about it, I suppose part of the logic is that imagine the marginalization and even oppression that perhaps peasants or laborers may have experienced within India on behalf of ruling classes, on behalf of, you know, the middle class, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whether it's a caste issue or a class issue. And so it's it is a fascinating phenomenon. And these days, we can no longer draw conclusions about, you know, someone might be of a West Indian background, but relatively successful, someone might be born and bred in New York City and be a lazy bum. but it's fascinating to hear your perspectives on that.
So the world has become much smaller, and that's a really good thing. Actually, in the United States, there are as many people from Norwegian background as there are Norwegians in Norway. And the Norwegian state was very clear that those Norwegians who are left, they are no longer Norwegians. So they had the same, same view that the Norwegian nation couldn't afford to have any kind of responsibility for those people, Norwegians living in the United States. So it was probably a kind of a, maybe a normal thing, but with the changing of the world and the world becoming much smaller and more consciousness about it, then these things are also changing. So
yeah, I like the parallel to the Norwegian situation, and what I would suspect is, by and large, as you say, it's an economic concern. Perhaps even a cultural one. I would say that in the Indic context, the cultural dimension is exasperated, colored by class and caste issues that operate even within the nation state, much less without. And another piece that's interesting to me is I use the word Indic more often than not. I didn't quite like the word at all for a number of years. And in recent years, I use the word Indic to indicate Indian in a cultural sense. Because when I say Indian, people might think Indian in a nation state sense. And of course, think about the indentured laborers in their thousands who ended up in the West Indies. This is long before the nation state was forged. And so it really is a fascinating phenomenon. The last question for you, just say you were doing a public talk or teaching undergrads, or you have a naive interlocutor like myself asking you, a question along the following lines, how would you answer? So what are some of the features of Indian diaspora, of Hindu diaspora? What are some of the overarching features that we can glean about the Hindu diaspora?
Hmm. Well, I think let's talk about religion then. So I would say that the centrality of the temple, that has become, I think that's a main feature, and the preservation or the presentations of cultural tradition within the temple, like dance traditions, language, clothes, etc. So I think they, as a minority, when people go meet in the temples, often on for festivals especially, so that's also the diaspora phenomenon, a festivalization of religion. But when then people can be kind of 100%, let's see, South Asian Hindus in a temple, it's South Asian languages. So I think also the religion is very important for the Hindu diasporas. I mean, religion in the temples, religion is being recreated. So the connection to South Asia is important. Let's see the Ilam Tamil, who are the great temple builders in Europe. They kind of recreate the temple as the place to preserve and maintain the Ilam Tamil culture as much as possible. So even if they live separate places, they would meet there, maybe especially at festivals. So that will be, I think, one from a Hindu point of view. Now, of course, Hinduism is a extreme diverse tradition, or and that is also part of the diaspora. It's religiously very diverse, but then dominated perhaps by some, at least some traditions more than others. But Gujarati tradition, okay, but that's also very, these are also very diverse traditions. So that diversity and centrality of the temple and strong connections to South Asia often at least attempting to preserve South Asian languages, South Asian food, South Asian clothing. But maybe after a while, this will be in festival. There will be a kind of festivalization of these items of the culture, maybe not every day, but yes, maybe that will be the three things that I could think of now. But
great. Well, thank you for indulging me these questions. I was chatting briefly with a guest recently, and you know, for the vast majority of guests, we have never met, and a good many guests, actually, I'd say over half, easily over half of my guests have never done a podcast before. So you know, we chat about, you know, briefly about the process, and I said, you know, I ask just these general, basic, purposefully naive questions, and one of my guests said, "Yes, the hard ones." I said,
"That's true."
the hard ones. Oh, good. Anyhow, well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
So, thank you for having me. So it was nice to be able to have this chat on my book. So, thank you.
You're welcome. For those listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Knut Jacobsen, who is the editor of Hindu Diasporas as part of the Oxford History of Hinduism series. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep thinking, keep reading, and keep contemplating the movement of peoples across space and their expressions of religiosity in their new homes. Take care.